Welcome to BizRocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered in investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA/SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for BizRocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Good morning and welcome to BizRocket Radio. This is John Baker here with my colleague Stone Payton. Stone, how you been, man? It's been a couple weeks.
It's been a long time. It's good to be working with you again, man. You're looking fit.
Well, you know, summertime. You get a little tan. I was in the Caymans for a few days. That was kind of nice. I was in Arizona working hard. I didn't get outside too much in Arizona, but the Caymans, I snuck a couple of trips out there. That was good. I swam with stingrays.
Oh my! The last guy that we heard about that did that didn't turn out so well.
No, stabbed in the heart.
right.
That was.
So what was that like?
Crocodile.
Did you pet them? Did you touch them?
Oh yeah. You held them actually.
And do they feel like a little furry rabbit or a snake? Like, or what does it feel like?
Someone explained it like a wet, mushroom.
Okay.
Really soft, like silk almost. Yeah. Like it'd rub up against you and it was real soft.
Very
and then
cool.
You could hold them.
You took the kids?
Pam and I.
Yeah.
Pam actually got what they call a stingray kiss.
Oh my.
Which is basically she got bitten by a stingray.
Aha.
Because she was trying to hold it and it was a little bit PO'd and it decided to nip her a little bit.
But and now you're back with us, the regular people.
Yeah, the regular people. Blessing you with my presence. It's all good. How about you? What have you been up to?
I've been very busy. You know, we've been opening new studios all over town.
I know.
We've been doing a lot more remote work, and so we're very excited about that. One of the things that's on the horizon Friday is Entrepreneur Advisors. They're doing their symposium. They do that one of those about every other week.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be out at Cobb Energy Center, going to be doing remote broadcast, and they are simulcasting that event to these two cities, Shanghai, get this, Shanghai and Snellville. That's where the simulcast is going. But it promises to be a really cool event. And all kidding aside, I strongly encourage you, go to entrepreneuradvisors.com, look at the events. I think it's like $85 or something, and they've got the governor from Kentucky is coming to speak, Star Hall is speaking, you know, your favorite radio personality, Stone, will be there.
Really?
$85, what do you want?
Well, that's worth your price of admission is just listening to you
except
myself. That's good stuff. Well, we've got a great show today. We got several people in here that we're going to be talking to and learning from a business perspective. BizRocket Radio is designed to go through and get experiences from business owners and executives in the Atlanta area, learning about opportunities that they've had, experiences, challenges that they've faced, and kind of see where their business is going right now. And our first guest is Lee Moore, and Lee is with Bridge Career Management. Lee, how are you doing today?
I'm great, John. How are you?
I'm doing great. Maybe you could give us a little bit of background on you and your business.
Okay. I'm a career coach, and I started my own business about 12 years ago after I was laid off and began my business and had wanted to do career development type of work and started out doing contract work for outplacement firms, steadily grew my own business, and have an area of specialty in the federal government arena.
And you're in Atlanta?
I'm in Atlanta.
Wow.
How about that?
Well, there's a few government organizations here, aren't there?
Yes. As a matter of fact, Atlanta ranks number 4 for federal jobs outside of Washington, D.C. for the largest agencies.
And what would those be? CDC?
CDC. We have a lot of regional offices here, like EPA and things like that.
Really?
Of course, Social Security is here, and we have FBI and So we have, you know, CDC definitely is the largest.
You know, it's interesting. You get Atlanta, you don't think of as being, you know, a major hub for government businesses at all. But that's the case, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We are a regional hub. Mm-hmm.
Now, do people seek you out, people that have been downsized or whatever the current euphemism is, fired? Do they seek you out, or do you find them? Do you have some sort of marketing strategies that you get to these people? How does that piece work?
Well, I do. I teach classes evening at Emory Center for Lifelong Learning. I teach federal government classes there, the Knowledge Shop up in Marietta. And I get a lot of referrals because I've been doing this for quite a while.
Because you're good at it, right?
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, yes.
That's what they teach in referral school. If you're good at it, you get referrals, right?
There you go.
So if I was wanting to get into a federal government type position, is there anything in particular that they're really looking for from a resume perspective or experience standpoint?
The federal government hiring process is very different than private sector. So private sector, you tend to have a 1-2-page resume depending upon your length of experience. The government resumes tend to be 4 pages or longer.
Imagine that. Never saw that coming. Yeah.
No, more paperwork can't be the government we're talking about.
Yes, it's true.
So they expect a lot more detail and information.
Yes, they interview less. The private sector is much more wired in their process toward, you know, the resume, you know, get somebody's interest. Yeah, this person could do the job. Let's bring them in. Let's evaluate their fit, you know, that type of thing. And then there's tends to be, you know, good number of interviews. But the federal government does not interview very much, sometimes not at all. Some people get hired, no interview.
Really?
It's hired off the paper. Yes.
Wow.
And so what you submit is far more critical, and they don't make any assumptions about us based on our job title. So if somebody was a secretary, then in the private sector, we assume that you do certain things, you know. But in the government, you have to write down everything on that application. You know, it's much more detailed and to match yourself to the job.
Yeah.
So
And what do you see as being opportunities right now in the federal government? If somebody's saying, hey, you know, I wouldn't mind working for the government, good pension, et cetera, what kind of things are open right now?
Well, that varies, you know, by agency. And one of the misconceptions that people have is that there is one federal government hiring process. Certainly there are a lot of standards across all agencies, but some agencies can use a paper application. Not many of those do anymore, but that's still an option. Some use USA Jobs. Others use different sites. So there are different parameters that each agency can have. What I recommend if somebody's looking at the government is to go out to, like, USA Jobs, put on some job alerts out there for job titles that they might apply for in the private sector world, and then, because those titles are typically not the same in the government. But then start to get a feel for some of the jobs that are in the government that they might match with. So, for example, in the government, there are a lot of program jobs, program management, program analyst, somebody who does all the reporting, program admin type of work. Where in the private sector, we don't tend to use, you don't walk around and find tons of program managers. There are some out there. And there are more project managers. But so the titles are different. So that's an important first step.
Yeah. Now, what would you say is a, personal experience, right? My stepdad worked for the Corps of Engineers in D.C. And I remember going into that building and feeling like the life was sucked out of me. I mean, I remember being a kid, you know, after college, graduating and going in. And he would be like, you know, he was just, he did not enjoy, now the career, he was there for 35 years or something like that, you know, and he made it a great career and got a great pension and everything else. But the thing that he said is it's not a very vibrant work environment. Two questions. A, do you find that a lot in these government organizations? And B, what might be if you didn't want that environment and you still wanted to work for the government, but you wanted something that was a little bit more upbeat? Do you have any suggestions on what branches to maybe look at?
Well, every entity has their own sort of personality. And
I'm thinking black ops. Things are move a little different pace.
That's right. I think they're hiring for that. I think you'd fit the mold for that.
So I would encourage somebody to network, very much to network, just the same way you would do in the private sector, to find out what's it like to work for XYZ company. Then you'd want to find out what's it like to work for ABC agency, you know, and see what the personality is, what they do, kind of what's the structure, to see if you fit in. And I actually had a client who came from IBM and interviewed with the government, and they asked her, why do you think that you would fit into our culture? You know, are you aware that things may be different, you know, from the corporate world? So I would encourage people to, you know, network around and see. And, of course, a lot of times our experience of a job is the department we're in. So maybe the entire agency may be, you know, whatever that persona might be, but maybe the department we're in is a really cool group that clicks, you know. So I think that's an important factor to evaluate, too.
She didn't answer my second question. So is there, what's your favorite? What's that branch or that group? Can you say? Are you allowed to say that? Or are you going to be ostracizing all these other groups?
I don't know if I have a favorite.
You don't really have a favorite?
Yeah.
But the big ones in Atlanta, CDC, FBI, you mentioned, Social Security Administration.
Social Security is big. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, CDC would definitely be the very largest agency here.
Now, I understand that there's been some changes to the whole hiring process that apparently had been come down as a mandate from the president. What's that all about?
Okay, last year in May, President Obama issued an executive order to streamline the federal hiring process. That included wanting more touch points with candidates. The government process is slow. Slower than private sector, although that has certainly gotten a lot slower over the last few years. And so in the government, candidates, they have a great candidate, got them all lined up, they're rated very highly qualified, then they don't hear anything for months, you know, so they don't know, is the job still on, what's going on, that type of thing. So they have more systems now to, you know, periodically notify candidates about the status. And also, he said he wanted the hiring managers more involved in the front end of the process. The hiring managers tend to be more on the receiving end of, here's your list of people who are rated best qualified. He wants them more involved on the front end. And then also elimination of something that they call KSAs, knowledge, skill, and ability addendums, where on many government applications in the past, you've had to write up, you know, 3/4 of a page narrative about your skill, giving an example, a story that illustrates your skill in a certain area. And this was really, really a behavioral interview question, but in writing. And so that really bogged the process down. It's a good way to evaluate people. And this now calls upon candidates to try and weave some of that content in very reduced form into the resume now, because they still evaluate us the same way. They're just asking for less visible proof.
Have you seen this as a helpful change? Has that been implemented effectively?
It started November of last year, and, you know, it'll be in stages. Some of it is definitely the agencies are not asking for as much from candidates. Makes it a little more challenging for candidates because, again, the criteria about how you're going to be evaluated hasn't changed, but just the volume of paperwork that you submit. So making the resume even more fine-tuned and making your credentials and experience, your qualifications even more evident within the resume now is more critical.
So, I mean, it sounds like everything is wrapped into this 6-page document that you turn in as a quote-unquote resume, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just critical to know what to get on there, how to address it, how to pose your experiences in a positive light. That's got to take a little bit of skill. Is that something that you're helping people with when you're working with them?
Definitely every day.
So that's a big part of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
How often do people actually do face-to-face interviews? Does it happen often?
Yes, I mean, there's still face-to-face interviews. I mean, definitely the private sector is very much geared for that. Usually multiple, minimum two. And within the government, it's usually more like one interview and not, you know, sometimes over the phone. People have gotten hired over the phone sometimes, too.
Yeah. What would you change about that process if you could?
It's only an hour show.
Sorry. Well, let's see.
A top thing.
I think that screening people for a fit is really good. And that's the hardest piece to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I think that a little more screening for the fit, but that doesn't enter ostensibly in the government process, because usually when you submit a resume, somebody rate and ranks you. You mm-hmm. know, like get your pen out, rate and rank, or either it's screened through technology. Some level of the screening may be performed by technology, but then people read it. They rate and rank and take to the hiring manager the list of best qualified people. And so that's a pretty skill-oriented ranking. And I don't always see that there's much strategy of like, well, this person is really good because the department manager is going to be retiring in 4 years. They've got leadership experience. Let's choose this person over somebody else. So that doesn't ostensibly come into the mix as much
right.
when you have that type of an evaluation system.
Do you do any kind of like personality testing with your applicants to see if they're going to fit into certain areas?
I do. People who are looking at choosing a career path, you know, mid-career folks going, accomplished pretty much a lot of what I wanted to do in this job. I'm thinking there's maybe something else for me to do. So, yes, I do that. Personality, interest testing.
Great. Good stuff.
The less personality you have, the more the better fit you are for like accountant, lawyer, something like that. I have a great idea for a new government education program.
All right.
Because if you got one of these government jobs, you're obviously very adept at creative writing. So maybe they
there
can turn around and teach creative writing, right? There's a lot of writing involved in it.
There is a lot of writing involved. I don't know it's that creative, you know, in terms of, you know, you just match yourself up. You
yeah,
know?
Do got to match the right places, right?
Take
yeah.
a quick minute, if you will, as we wrap this conversation up, though. Walk us through your process. Like, if I wanted to engage you, because I'm getting serious about going after one of these, particularly these government jobs, how would we work together? What would that look like?
Well, I teach classes, and so that's one way that I work with people. And then I work with them if they find a particular job. Then they send me the, you know, the job link, and they send me their resume, and then we meet. And I go through, and I, you know, walk through a process of, okay, have you ever done this? And I tell people you need three types of information under every job. Tell me something about what the company does, because some people like launch into customer service and blah, blah, blah. I have no idea who your customer is, what your company sells. So give me that. And then also ask them about the job title, what they do in the job. And then I also ask about what they excel at in the job, their accomplishments.
Nice. That sounds like that would be a really effective and helpful process.
Perfect. Perfect. So one of the things that we like to ask all our guests is to get an idea of a pearl of wisdom they can share with our listeners. So if you had a pearl of wisdom that you could share with people out there to help them understand how to be more efficient or effective in business or in a career, what would that be?
Come on the Biz Rocket Radio Show.
Okay.
That's the best trampoline to your career.
That's
ever.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. I will say this. This is, I also teach meditation. And one of the things that fascinates me is our world is so into all the social media and connecting and connecting. And then you walk past a group of people sitting at a restaurant outside, and all three of them are sitting there with each other, but then they're on their PDAs, you know?
So true.
And I'm like, okay. And so what I think people need to do is to learn to connect inside of themselves. You know, do something to learn more about who you are, and then you can connect with other people from a very real perspective.
Very good. Very good. I hadn't had that one yet. That's a good one.
Okay.
Nice.
So you heard it first.
I heard it first here with Lee Moore. So share with us your contact information. If somebody wants to get in contact with you, what's the best way to do that?
My website is bridgecareermanagement.com. It's one very long URL with no abbreviations. And my cell phone's 404-680-6506.
Okay, so this is Lee Moore with Bridge Career Management. Thank you, Lee. All right, so our next guest is Eric Bell, and Eric is the Director of Sales and Service with Franchise Gator. Eric, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure. So maybe you could share with us a little bit about your background and Gator Franchise.
Well, actually, prior to being with Franchise Gator, I was a franchisee. I was working for a tanning concept called Hollywood Tans. I was a franchisee. I also worked for them. In the area, I was heading up the operations in the area. I even sold franchises a little bit. And then in 2000, that was in 2002. In 2005, I joined Franchise Gator, working on the sales team. So that put me in contact with franchisors, selling them advertising space, if you will, on the website. And have been there ever since. So it's almost 6 years now. And, you know, worked my way up the ranks and was a sales manager after a couple years with Franchise Gator, and now director of the sales department as well as the service department, which you know, helps support the customers.
So are you working with the customers directly trying to find those franchises, or are you referring them over to staff or people that you're working with?
No, I am working with the customers directly. The sales staff is bringing them on board, and then I'll facilitate the process a little bit, teach them how to be successful with our site. As a company, our focus is both on helping our franchisors be successful in finding good qualified leads and convert them to candidates. But also, obviously, we want to focus on the budding entrepreneur and create a great platform for them to find the perfect opportunity for them.
And how do you find the right kind of franchise for somebody? I mean, that's got to be something pretty difficult. And obviously, why they're coming to you is saying, look, I've heard about this great franchise stuff, but I don't know which one is going to be right for me. What's your process in doing that?
Well, the way that the site is structured, we're actually not in touch with the people who come to the site. So we're simply a platform. And in the industry, we're known as a franchise portal, which actually a pretty telling word to describe us, because we simply are sort of the introduction into the franchising industry for anybody who just says, hey, let me see what's out there. And so they come to the site, and we try and just make it very easy to browse through hundreds of opportunities, franchise opportunities, even business opportunities as well. And we provide a cut sheet, if you will, a couple paragraphs. And once they've we've piqued their interest about a couple opportunities, it's their job to sort of raise their hand and shoot off their information to those companies and say, I want to learn a little bit more. And so that's when the process really begins.
So is there like a Match.com aspect to this where I say, look, I'm lazy, I'm not going to work on Wednesdays, I only have $5,000, and then you send me to these things? Or do I just start searching for certain industries? When I get on your site, how do I conduct my process?
It's pretty simple. So there's no questionnaire, if you will, but you can narrow your search down.
That's a million-dollar idea. You can have that.
Yeah, let's keep that between ourselves, all right? We have some things going on in the background. I don't need you spilling our secrets.
All
but
right.
You narrow your search down based upon industry, your interests, geography. What area do you want to open up your franchise? And, of course, on financials as well, which in most cases will drive your choices down to very few. There's hundreds of opportunities, but once you've searched around the site, it's very easy to narrow your search down to, you know, 5 or 10.
So I really could, though, go in and say, look, I got $25,000. Is there anything even out there? And I could do that like I would do if I were shopping for a car on Auto Trader, right?
Absolutely.
So what's hot right now? What kind of franchises are selling? What are people really interested in jumping on right now?
Well, since the economy turned, anything that has a lower investment level, and what I mean by that is probably under $100,000, has really generated a lot of interest. Right now, in-home senior care is probably one of the hottest industries right now. Very little overhead. Most of the retail shops, anything brick and mortar, They're having a tougher time finding qualified prospects than they were a couple years ago when you can leverage 150% of your home to buy a franchise. Those days are long gone. So, and a lot of concepts out there are actually trying to come up with they're trying to sort of revise their opportunity a little bit and make maybe an express, you know, portion of their opportunity available, a smaller entity or maybe a mobile entity available to prospects, so that way they can lower the cost. So that's what you're seeing a lot of. So anything that's mobile or home-based business is generating a lot more interest nowadays.
Well, I want the listening audience to know for $100,000, you can have my job right now. You can
for
run
sale.
The studio every day.
Everything's
for sale. That's right.
Including your job.
Right.
So what kind of demographics are you attracting? Are you seeing that you're getting the people that are in that executive transition, that they're looking for that second career kind of thing, or is it more attractive to someone younger, maybe more versed in the internet? What's your typical demographic?
It's all over the board. We'll get kids in their 20s. We'll get people who lost a job and are a little bit more desperate, if you will, a little bit more motivated in that sense. And then, of course, we'll get the executives who finally had enough of answering to someone else, and you know, they want to use some of their retirement funds to go into business for themselves. And then, of course, the retiree who wasn't really ready to be a retiree. And he'll join the fray as well.
And what do you see as being the thing that has you stand out? There's a lot of other groups and organizations and franchise people that help with this process. Mm-hmm. What is the thing that makes you guys different?
Well, when it comes to websites that offer hundreds of opportunities like we do, there are a handful of us, and it's simply a matter of can we get in front of the candidate when they decide at that moment, all right, I'm going to go see what's out there. I mean, there's many places they can start, obviously the search engines, but you know, there's other business-related websites out there, and eventually we want those searches to lead back to us. So it's a matter of, you know, how far of a reach do we have? And if we can show franchisors, hey, we have a bigger reach than some of our competitors, they're going to want to get in front of us. It's that's what they're looking for, an opportunity to get in front of as many eyes as possible. And the more people we can attract to advertise on the site, obviously the more plentiful the site is, which makes it more attractive for the candidates. So it's a little bit sickler like that.
Are the candidates that are coming to search on your site, are they the ones that are going to be paying fees and costs for your services, or how are you getting paid?
It is the companies that are advertising. So those that are on the site, those are the ones that are paying us. Mm. The candidates that come to the site, it's a free service, which makes it very attractive.
Is it mainly the franchises that are advertising their franchises on there, or is it something else that's being advertised, like, you know, diapers or, you know,
no,
beer or something?
It's just their opportunity. So it's okay. That's simply what we're offering, and it's not existing units. There are sites out there that offer existing units. That's not us. We're simply offering an opportunity for someone to start from scratch, even though they're taking someone else's concept.
So tell us more about the site itself. There's so you go in, you search, and you lay in a few criteria, like the initial investment, maybe geography, I don't know, but you narrow your search down, and you start looking for stuff. Is there anything else associated with the site? Are there links to articles about franchising? Or because I'm thinking, I've been in business for a long time, but I don't know the first thing about buying a franchise. I think I'd want to have some access to some thought leadership and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we have a resource center. We're actually in the process of really building that out. There's so much information out there, and we really want to be, we want to really help people and hold their hands more so than we're doing now. Right now, as I said, we're just a platform, and there's so much opportunity to take a candidate and really show them how to shop properly, because it can be scary. And I tell people that I work with, the franchisors, I tell them that, especially those that are new to this, I say selling a franchise is the hardest sale that you will ever encounter. It's harder than selling a home, selling a car. There's way more emotion involved in this. And so you have to understand what this candidate is going through. And so from that perspective, we want to get in front of these candidates, and we want to show them how to make a good, informed decision, because it can be extremely overwhelming.
Is it like selling a vacuum cleaner? You know, you knock on the door, and the husband's not home. You say, I'll come back when all the buyers are here.
But before the economy turned. Yeah, it was pretty much like that.
Right?
But, no, it's certainly not that simple.
I mean, I can imagine going home and explaining to Holly, yeah, I'm going to put $100,000. You're 401, Holly, and we're going to get us a Jiffy Lube. And
that ain't going to happen.
That's one of the biggest mistakes our customers make is they'll get in a great conversation with a candidate and forget to ask who else is part of the decision-making process. So, of course, when they do get home and they get to dinner and they tell their wife that they're looking into draining their savings account, guess what? Our customer doesn't hear from that candidate again.
But what franchisor in their right mind, I can't imagine, and I don't want to diminish the importance of the job because I'm sure it's tough too. I can't imagine a franchisor knowing about this portal and telling your salesperson, no, I don't want to be a part of it. I mean, when you get a no, what are they saying no to? They got to want to be in front of these people.
Well, absolutely. There's a lot of choices, and there's a lot of ways to get in front of potential franchise candidates. So, you know, working leads from a site like Franchise Gator can be kind of tough. It's kind of like walking through a trade show, and people walking through a trade show are just gathering information. That's what we're doing. There's ways to get someone who may be a little bit further down the decision-making process, maybe through their own search engine marketing, maybe through some social media outlets. So everybody's trying, you know, different avenues. And of course, there's a financial investment, and are you getting a return on that investment? And that's my job, is to coach everybody and make sure that they're handling our leads the right way, because there is a process. I've seen people come away and be very frustrated with our service, and after a quick conversation, I tell them that there's a little bit of a different way that they really need to be handling the leads that we're sending to them, and that makes all the difference in the world sometimes.
Are you meeting with these individuals face-to-face at any part in this process, or is it really all maybe over the phone a little bit and the website?
You mean the franchisors, our customers?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's all over the phone. We do a couple trade shows, and that's really our time to get face-to-face with some of these customers who we talk with daily. The franchising community is very small. And so we have a great relationship with a lot of these people that we work with, but we actually don't get a chance to meet with them face to face except for those couple trade shows a year.
And what about the people buying the franchises? Do you meet with them at all?
Nope, not at all. We don't communicate with them. We simply hand off their information to the franchisor, and it's at that point that they're going to foster a relationship with the franchising company and work their way to actually having a sit down with them, maybe in a discovery day format.
Hmm. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Great. So, same question that we asked before in terms of pearls of wisdom. You've been in this franchising business for a while, and obviously in other areas. What would you share as your pearl of wisdom with listeners in terms of successful business?
You know, if you're shopping for a franchise, there is a misconception that it's almost a guaranteed ticket to success because you're following someone else's format. And the statistics can be a little bit misleading. So just make sure you understand what you're getting into. Make sure that you do your proper research. Make sure you have good guidance. And talk with people who have been in the shoes that you want to step in and see what their experience has been. And there's so much information out on the internet these days. There's no way that anybody should go and make a decision like this ill-informed.
I'd like him to come back. I'd like you to come back with a franchisor that's been using your service for a while and have them describe the experience of using your platform to attract good quality candidates. Would you be up for that? Would that be a fun?
Yeah, absolutely. Franchising, Atlanta's a great hub for franchisors. There's a terrific organization down here called the Southeast Franchise Forum, which probably has 100 members at this point. And they meet, I believe, every month. Atlanta's a terrific hub. There's plenty of people to choose from.
Don't you feel like we could have like a special series and have some and just talk franchising?
Cool. There's all sorts of different aspects of getting into franchises. It's the person that's buying it. There's these coaches that help the person that's buying it. There's you guys that help the franchisors that are trying to sell it.
Like a round table.
Yeah, get the aspects from all different angles.
Yeah,
franchising
cool.
is a fascinating industry. You can fill hours of talk time. I promise you that.
How about 50 minutes? 55 minutes, we'll do that. Because, Stone gets to talking and you just yap.
I'm feeding into that. Yeah, I thought he would buy into that.
All right, so if somebody wants to get in contact with you and maybe get in contact with your organization, Eric, what's the best way to do that?
You can email me, eric.bell, E-R-I-C, dot B-E-L-L, at franchisegator.com, G-A-T-O-R. Look me up on LinkedIn. Connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter. But that's the easiest way to get a hold of me.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having
hopefully
me.
You can hang out for a little bit. We'll we got a couple more people to chat with, and we'll go from there. So our next guest is Carrie Green. Carrie is with CSC and is a solutions executive there. And I've known Carrie through Kettering for quite some time, and just want to chat with him a little bit about his business and a little bit on his experience in terms of background. Carrie, maybe you could give us a little bit of background on you.
Sure. Good morning, guys. I've been in the IT services business about 25 years. I started off way back in sales. Over the years, retrained, worked in engineering operations, last several years in executive management, and then all along that way, been involved in some sort of business development. The nature of our business is most of the selling comes from the operational type folks in these very large deals, because the customer doesn't want to deal with salespeople. They want to deal with the guys who do the work and know what they're talking about. So,
and what's in dealing with these larger cases, what do you give us a feel for what that's like? I mean, what is it like being? I've talked to you off air about some of these cases. You've had some crazy situations.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, I guess we should talk about, I mean, the size of the deal that I generally work on. It's anywhere from 200 to 300 million up to several billion. And
wow, I knew he just walked differently than the rest of us. Did you saw him when he came in? He's a different strut about it. Right? So there's like the billion-dollar strut.
That's the chafing. these kinds of opportunities are fascinating. First of all, they take a long time. You know, it's not the kind of process that you slam down in a month. The largest deals I've worked on can take upward of 18 months. So it's a marathon, and you've got to have the ability, the stamina, to last through the entire thing. And then, as you pointed out, we've chatted, there are the craziest things that happen in these deals because tensions are high. When you're talking about the kind of deal that I normally work on, you're talking about publicly traded companies. So Wall Street's watching very, very closely. And if the deal goes bad, the stock goes down for either the vendor or for the client. So there's a lot at stake. There's a lot of very senior exposure, and exposure is not necessarily a good thing. Okay, you can die from exposure. So
I thought there was no bad.
Oh no, no, this
there is bad.
Yeah, there's
that's
bad,
a myth.
Yeah, when you get a phone call from the secretary or the chairman of the board, and she wants to have a meeting with you later in the day, that's not good.
Not a good.
Not
thing.
A good thing. That's not bad. That's bad. Not that I know that personally.
No, that's just what you heard.
I've heard.
Yeah, you've heard from other people.
Not a good thing. So you have that aspect to it. The bid cost is extremely high. On these deals, bid cost can be upwards of 1-2% of deal value. So you're talking about spending several million dollars, and you may not win. You don't want to be the guy you don't want to be the guy to go stand in front of your boss and say, "We just spent $42 million, but we lost." And the largest deal that I've worked on, our bid cost is about $45 million. We won, thank heavens. But you imagine the other team we're competing against, they had to have that conversation because I'm sure they spent the same amount we spent to win.
These are two different companies bidding to buy a third.
It's outsourcing. So what you're doing is you're taking over the operation of some company, their IT operation.
Right.
And you
spend $45 million to get the business.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Easily. Wow. On a very large deal. I mean, that deal was worth it was about $3 billion. So when you think about it, though, in those terms, if you're going to invest $45 million and get $3 billion back, I think we'd all do that if we had the pocket money. But
that's like taking a guy out to lunch and hoping you sell him, right?
Exactly.
It's
so
just
you know,
different, playing at a different
it's
level.
Just, yeah, you know, and it's interesting because when
it's
I started...
all basis points, man.
Yeah.
It's all about basis
right.
points.
You know, when I started doing these very large deals, it was a little shocking. I mean, you know, because I'd worked in like single million dollar digit big deals prior to that. And then the first large one I did was about $250 million. And at first, those numbers are a little overwhelming, especially when you write them out on paper. You
know,
lots of zeros.
Yeah,
you just keep doing zeros. The billion one was even a lot more zeros. But after a while, you realize it's only because of the size, the scope, that it's a lot of small parts that just add up to a whole lot of big stuff.
Yeah.
So you have those other issues. We get back to your question. So you've got a lot of risk. You've got a lot of exposure. You've got a very complex sell. And so it makes for a real interesting ride.
What is there anything that people do that you found in these types of situations that lead to a higher success rate? I mean, what's important?
I found in my personal experiences is that pursuit strategy is the most important thing. And what I mean by that is when you approach a deal, you have to have a strategy by which you approach. And you can think of strategy in sort of five ways. You've got a direct strategy, an indirect, containment, divisional, and exit. And those are the kind of broad scope. Jim Holden did a lot of writing about this back in the 70s and 80s. But the bottom line is there are ways of approaching a deal. For instance, if the customer, you had a long-running relationship with this customer, you've been doing business with them on a number of different ways for a number of different years, and they come to you and they say, you know, love you guys, really would like you to get this piece of business. However, because we're publicly traded, we're under scrutiny, I've got to take it out to the street, we've got to let people bid, but if you guys are, you know, can come in competitive, we'll give you the business. All right, that kind of relationship would dictate a direct strategy, meaning you've got competitive advantage, the customer tells you as long as you meet their buying criteria, they're going to buy from you. So you would tend to bid exactly what they would want. On the other hand, if you didn't have that relationship, you have to assume somebody else does.
Mm-hmm.
Right? because if it's not you, it's somebody else. And there's never a guess. You can't guess. Okay, you'll know.
And these relationships are built like years. You build anything.
Yeah, and they're built over years of doing smaller and smaller business till you get to bigger and bigger business.
Yeah.
And then, but as you know, the other example, so if you didn't have that relationship, you might want to use an indirect strategy where you don't bid what the customer wants. You change the game. I can give you an incredible example of this where I was actually beat by a firm that did this extremely well. I'll leave firm names out to protect the guilty. But we were bidding about a $220 million bid for an aerospace and defense firm. And we had a very long-standing relationship. Again, they loved us. It was great. We take a direct strategy because we think we're in. You know, we're getting all the right signals from all the right senior execs. And the way these deals go is after you go through this crazy bidding process, they have these orals where you sit down face-to-face, kind of like we're doing here. And they basically go line by line through your proposal, and they say, you know, on line 351, you said X. What did you mean by that? Is it included in your price?
I'd starve to death in that business.
Yeah,
I said, what?
Yeah, that's where the pressure's really on.
Remember that?
Yeah, and there's generally lawyers in the room, and they're videotaping. It's great. So, yeah, you have a lot of fun with that. But anyway, so we came out of the orals, our group, and we had the first session in the morning. We thought, oh, man, we got it. We nailed it. Second group comes in behind us. That afternoon, we get told we lost the deal. What do you mean we lost the deal? Well, here's what happened. The other team found the best friend of the CEO of the firm. They were both retired Air Force generals. They hired him without any idea they were going to win a piece of business. And when they got in front of the client at the orals, they said, now, if you were to hire us to pick our contract, this gentleman here will be your program manager. Oh, you two guys know each other, don't you? These guys play golf together every Saturday. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, they killed us. They just killed us.
I was just going to ask that. Is it how important are the personal relationships there? That's your ace in the hole, right?
They are very important. And, you know, in this case, the indirect strategy had nothing to do with the bid. They did something different and won. The relationships are important. And when you go after these large deals, you tend to do a lot of background checks. You tend to find out, because they're publicly traded companies, so you find out who are the execs, where do they go to college, what clubs are they a member, are they in the military, they have this, and you try to match your executives with their executives to try and get that connection, that hit.
Mm-hmm.
So you work on a lot of different levels when you work on these deals. There's lots of moving parts that you're pulling different levers and doing different things.
Now, you've done some work on turnaround type stuff as well. How's that different?
Well, it's different because the ultimate outcome. Well, the ultimate outcome is a little bit different. The process you go through. I mean, in large scale outsourcing, you know, you're in a bid process. You're trying to win a piece of business for your company. In the turnaround, you've got I've always done it internally. I've always been, you know, there's been an internal organization that's in the ditch, and the boss comes and says, Carrie, there's a problem. You need to parachute in and fix this. So it's a little different premise coming in. It's hostile from the minute you come in. In a bid process, that's not necessarily the case, and so you land in, you know, use a metaphor, you land in the hot LZ, and you got to fight your way out, and you've got to fight your way out trying to achieve the outcome that the corporation wants you to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different. It takes the same amount of chutzpah, if you know that term, to pull it off. But it's a lot of fun. I've done a lot of both, and it's interesting.
So I would imagine your frequent flyer miles are probably fairly high.
Yeah.
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 You have your own corporate jets?
No.
No, they don't have it yet?
Well, they do. I don't get to ride.
You don't get to ride? I think you might need to.
Yeah.
Now that you've been on Biz Rocket, they may...
Maybe now. I'm a celeb.
You know. I would think. Yeah,
exactly.
Look what I got going for
So is there much change management, leadership consulting that falls out of these deals? And do you guys have a change management practice, or do you refer that business out to folks, or how does that work?
Generally, there's an awful lot of what we call transformation on these deals, on the outsourcing deals.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is, as the outsourcer... It appears like it's a sale, but it's really a purchase. It's almost like an M&A, merger and acquisition process, because you're looking at that customer's business and you're making a determination that you can run it better than they can run it.
Yeah.
And so you keep certain things in your back pocket that you know you're going to do after you take over the business, but you don't necessarily reveal that in contract negotiations, because those are the things you have to do to drive cost out of the model, because that's where you make your profit. Okay, so there's an awful lot of what we call transformation activities. It's part of what you do as a large-scale outsourcer, and it's just part and parcel of what you do. And it's all based on change management and, you know, good old project management methodologies and such.
But do you talk about that you do or don't talk about that at all going into the deal? Is that attractive that you have a change management capability, or they don't care about all that crap? Just show me the spreadsheet.
Well, no, the way it really works is the customer has certain objectives they're trying to achieve.
Right.
And they lay those out and say, you have to achieve these objectives. So you have to, and there's cost is always part of it. You know, you've got to lower my cost by X percent. But also, you know, they may want to get into new technologies. They may want to transform how they run their operation. Maybe they want to get into new markets and they don't have an IT presence in those new markets. So they'll outsource that function to you. Like, you know, they want to get into Asia Pac and they don't have an operation in Asia Pac. So maybe they're asking you to stand up, you know, an operation in Asia Pac for them.
Yep.
So there's different objectives, and your goal as the, you know, the vendor should try and meet those objectives for the client. So it's a little different.
So in these deals, is there any equity that you're getting from a benefit or a compensation standpoint, or is it all pretty much cash?
They're usually a cash transaction, although I have seen in past where a certain amount of equity or payment in stock for some of this. It's rare that happens.
Well, I would think it would make sense, because you're going in and you're saying, I'm going to take over this whole department, which is X amount of your profit margin, and if I do a great job with it, then I'm going to get paid a lot more. If I don't do a great job, wouldn't that make sense?
It does, except that when you have stockholders and you're publicly traded as a vendor, that doesn't play well with your board.
Yeah. Because the shares.
Yeah, you're diluting. And you're not guaranteed to actually get the value that you think you're going to get. Because, again, when you sign these contracts, they can be 3, 5, 7, 10-year contracts. What's the value of that equity going to be 5 or 10 years from now? I mean, if we could predict that, we wouldn't be sitting here. We'd be, you know, we'd be playing on the market all the time and making tons of money.
You could use like phantom stock in that situation pretty easily.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. No, it doesn't seem to be.
Now we know why the big long disclaimer at the front of the show, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's not a comfort zone mostly for the buyers. Again, publicly traded. A lot of scrutiny around all those stock-type transactions, and they get uncomfortable. A couple of years ago, one of the first large deals I did, we proposed to the client that we would take a certain percentage of our payment in stock, because at the time they were trading for $4, and we thought for sure they were going to do better, and I will leave out names, but within about a year they were at $65. So it would have been a very nice return on investment if they had gone for it, but their organization came back and said, no, we're not interested in doing it.
They just want cash for services, and you take care of this,
and if
you're not doing well, we're going to fire you and get somebody else in there.
Well, and all these deals always include a penalty structure. There is always a penalty structure. By not achieving certain key performance objectives, you have to usually refund back a certain amount of your proceeds, and that's usually on a monthly basis. So there's a whole lot of incentive to get it right. Okay. And the penalties can be pretty steep, especially on these bigger deals. Yeah, they can nail you.
All right.
Yeah, they're not kind.
We got to wrap up a little bit. But before we go with you, key piece of advice, your pearl of wisdom for listeners?
Pearl of wisdom. Well, I think my wife would question the premise of the question, first of all, if there's wisdom here to begin with. But but thanks for the vote of confidence.
Well, you know, you got to walk in with a swagger.
Yeah, so well, what
leave
heck?
With a swagger.
What the heck? You know, I'm reminded of what George Carlin once said. He said, you know, don't sweat the petty things and don't pet the sweaty things. And what I mean
you
by...
You stop talking. That's perfect, yeah, right there.
You know? And cue music.
The music, yeah.
But in serious, what I mean is, you know, don't get distracted by all these little things that happen. Because on these large deals or these turnarounds, there's all kinds of competing things that want your attention, that want to distract you from the core. Always remember, what problem are we here to solve? And don't get distracted by all these little other things that happen, because there's a lot of things and people that want your attention. You got to really learn to focus it out and just work on the important things. So otherwise, you'll get distracted and pulled in lots of directions, and you'll never get to where you're trying to go. So that's probably the best I can share.
Great. Great stuff. So, Kerry, if somebody wants to get in contact, are you on LinkedIn?
I am on LinkedIn. Okay. That's probably the best way to reach me directly. You know, mm-hmm. CSC is 155 on the Fortune 500, so you could call the switchboard, but they probably don't know who I am.
Do you have a phone in the helicopter? Or?
No, they don't.
Not
no.
yet.
Incognito.
No.
You got to work on that, I'm telling
you. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Got to close a few more deals.
All right, Kerry, can you hang out for a minute?
Yeah, I will.
All right.
Thanks.
Well,
thanks,
guys. We appreciate your time, and I know you're traveling all over, but we'll look forward to talking to you again sometime in the near future, getting an update on some of these cases you're working on.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks.
Right. Good. So our next guest is Boozer McClure, and he is a clothier. And he's going to work on Stone here. He's going to work on getting him all squared away and
just going to be
up.
Like Rhubarb Jones doing the Slim Fast thing for 6 months. We'll have this whole program where Stone gets a suit. We'll just make a whole series out of
there
it.
There you
right?
go. There you go. It's going to be all about making Stone look like a smooth talking.
How does one get in the clothier? Am I saying that? The clothier business? What were you doing before you got in the clothier business? Just finishing serving your time, or
exactly. I have two music degrees. I have a bachelor's and a master's degree in music education, and I taught school. I was a high school band director for 7 years.
Oh, neat.
And had enough of that, and I had gotten married in the process, and my wife's dad had been in the real estate business here in Atlanta for a long time, made a lot of money, and I thought, you know, he's a smart guy. He's not any smarter than I am. So we moved from Birmingham, Alabama, to Atlanta, and I got in the real estate business for about 9 months. And it wasn't too different from, at that time, what we're going through right now. And I had a friend who had been trying to get me in the clothing business for 2 or 3 years, and I said, I know I'm going to be a big real estate magnate, you know. So finally, you know, timing is everything, and I rode with him one day, and the day that I rode with him, he sold about $15,000 worth of clothes to about 3 different people. And I said, I can do that.
That'll work.
I can do
that.
That
dog will hunt.
So I've been doing it 23 years.
Yeah. Wow, 23 years.
And all here in Atlanta.
You're probably starting to get it figured out by now, aren't
you? Kind of. You know, it changes every day, though.
Now, you sell suits, obviously, but you sell other stuff, too, right? Like what we call wealthy and casual over at my house.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I do.
Wealthy casual?
That's what Holly calls it.
Wealthy
yeah.
casual. All right. Yeah. I like that.
I do. I do slacks, shirts, casual, business casual, suits. You know, the people that I call on are really busy people for the most part, and so, you know.
You go to them.
I go to them. I don't have a storefront, so I go to these guys, and so their time is limited, and, you know, quite frankly, the biggest bang for my buck is in the, you know, the bigger articles, you know, suits, sport coats, slacks, and dress shirts. And then, you know, if they need belts or, you know, shoes and accessories, I have those as well, but... So
what kind of mistakes do most men make when it comes to dressing kind of like wealthy casual, or when it comes to wearing a suit? What kind of mistakes do we typically make because we don't know what we're doing?
Well, I would say taking shortcuts. You know, most men are not
smart
styling gurus. You know, they're not style gurus, and they're not fashionistas and that kind of thing. And
they don't like it, right? We don't like it.
It's just it's a pain in the butt, yeah, you know. Right. And so my job is just to make it really easy for guys to get nice clothing. And the mistakes that I see are they'll go shopping, and they'll find a really good deal, and they'll buy it, and then when I go in their closet, I see the tag still hanging on that they bought 3 years ago. They've never worn it, you know.
Doesn't fit quite right, or doesn't look quite right.
Yeah, they just didn't really like it. They just bought it because it was a good deal. And so my point to them is, you know, you should pay a little bit more for something that you will wear than, you know, $300 for a $1,000 suit that you're never going to wear.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So it's just money hanging in your closet.
So what's going on right now in the style world? What is in? What is out?
You know,
green ties are out, I think.
I don't really tout myself as a fashion type guy, I do stay in the what is current, you know. I mean, for instance, you know, suits lapels are getting a little bit narrower. There's a certain segment of the neckwear business, you know, ties that are getting a little bit narrower, but most of my customers are very traditional businessmen.
We're going to go back to the 80s with the leather thin tie.
Yeah, you know.
And the suit where you can, like, you jack them up to your elbows.
That's right.
You know, Ryan, what's his name?
Seacrest.
Seacrest, you know, that look, you know. Yeah, you know. But
we all know
not
who
a
he
big
is.
Fan. Yeah,
not a big fan. Although he is from Atlanta, Georgia.
He is from Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah. Yeah, he is.
So,
do you ever have a wife just write you a check and say, just fix the guy? Here, Boozer, here's the money. Just go to his office and get him dressed. I got five parties we got to do this fall.
I love it when that happens. And yes, that happens from time to time.
I can see my wife doing that.
Yeah.
Does the
wife tend to hire you, or does the husband tend to hire you?
Most of the times it's the husband, but it's amazing how many times, you know, the husband wants to bring the wife into the deal. So I try to find that out before I meet with him so I don't waste my time. Twice.
It's,
you
back
know,
to that one-legged sale we were
that's
talking
right.
about.
That's right. You go
right?
back out. It's always got to have both parties involved.
That's
right?
Exactly. And so you kind of pre-qualify that before you go meet with the person.
So what kind of pockets do you have to have to really take advantage of your services? Because I suspect some people feel like, well, you really have to be worth a lot of money and have a really big clothing budget. But my guess is you could probably meet a normal budget. Yeah.
Yeah. Misconception that what I do people can't afford. I mean, there's really no reason. You know, that anybody can't buy their business clothing or, you know, for that matter, their business casual clothing for me. I mean, I have sport coats that, you know, are $295, you know, and I have suits that are $495, and that's including the alterations. Now, those are off-the-rack items right there. My custom clothing, sport coat in my custom clothing line starts at $595, and a suit starts at $795. And then everything, you know, is based on fabrics from that point. You know, depending, and I guess some of the make of it, you know, if you have hand buttonholes or, you know, horn buttons and some of the nicer, you know, pieces that go into a suit or sport coat.
So walk us through this process. Let's say that you and I talk and I say, great, come back next week, and you come back. Walk me through what I will experience in working with you. You'll bring some fabric samples out. You'll measure me and write down short and fat, and then you'll guide the rest of the conversation to fit that. How does that work?
Well, generally speaking, I never come back. You know, I mean, you know, if I meet with you and you know why I'm there, we will either do business or, you know, we won't do business. I mean, again, I try to really do my job pre-qualifying a guy over the phone, find out if, you know, and he has to hit the 90% bracket that if I'm there and he likes what I have and he likes me, then we'll do business while I'm there, because I'm busy, he's busy, we don't have time to deal, you know, it's just close,
right?
You know? So so that's kind of the first mindset that I go into, but when I'm there, you know, I take a brief inventory of what he has in his closet. You know, he may tell me he has, you know, 20 suits in his closet, and then I'll say, do you wear all of them? You know, well, not really, you know. So you kind of have to pare it down to what he's actually wearing, and then I make some intelligent suggestions what might benefit him in his lifestyle. Just, you know, two or three things. You don't go overwhelming with the guy, you know. I mean, you just two or three things that will open up our relationship.
But you can sell him one suit now or a couple suits or whatever now, and you might be working with him for a lifetime.
Well,
right?
That's what I, you know, most of my customers I'll see twice a year. You know, there are some that every time I bring them something new, they'll buy something else, you know. But most of my customers, or every 6 months, I'll, you know, they'll you know, do something to enhance.
So, like a wealth management professional with deep pockets that wants to look good.
Wears a suit.
Can
every
you help
day.
Somebody like that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm just curious.
Exactly.
I don't know who that would be.
And can you print up that big
that
long
wouldn't be
disclaimer?
That wouldn't be it. Anyway.
Can you print up tags with that big long disclaimer? You know, and he yeah. can just open his coat. And
that's right. That's right. Exactly. Just make sure you all know. Here you go.
This is a benefit right here. So you can have stone painted
custom
inside
name.
Your
oh,
coat.
Oh, wow. Right there. That's very cool. That is
made it just
cool.
for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
What are some staples that you got to have in the suit world? You know, you're starting off, and you got to have these suits. What are they?
You know, if you were buying your son a couple of suits right out of college to start his business career or whatever, you know, you need a navy solid suit, a charcoal solid suit, and then a striped suit in each of those colors. So those would be four what I call the pillars of your wardrobe, and you can build everything else on top of that. But those you can pretty much wear any shirt and tie combination. And be out the door. You know, it's easy. You know, if you're a white shirt guy, you know, if you're a blue shirt guy. I try to get guys to get into some color because color is fun. You know, a lot of guys are afraid of it. You know, particularly guys that travel a lot, they want it to be easy. They don't want to have to pack a bunch of crap, you know, in the car and they're in overhead and in the plane. And so, you know, white shirts, they kind of tend to stick with. But if I can push them out a little bit into some fun shirtings or neckwear that, you know, they get compliments on during the day, then, you know, it elevates me in their eye, and then maybe we can open up for some more business.
So, let's turn to Kerry, the travel guy. Mm-hmm. So, what do you take with you on your trips?
He's exactly right. I have two blue, two gray.
23 years.
this is one of the gray I'm wearing today.
Yeah.
And also, I'm colorblind, so that works out really well.
I can run with you, man.
Yeah. I mean, I got
granimals in my closet.
Yeah,
I
have the adult. Yeah, I have the adult version. Yeah. Oh, my wife who says that doesn't go together.
That doesn't work.
Don't do that.
White, blue, and gray.
That's right.
Thank you.
I have
much.
Had guys that I put numbers in their ties to go with their shirts. Mm-hmm. You know.
Really?
It's not easy being colorblind.
But I do today. I'm wearing plain. But generally, I do wear like a light plaid shirt or striped shirt with just a real light.
Do you like a jacket? Do you wear many jackets or just suits?
I do. I have a black blazer, a blue blazer, and then a brown. So I can kind of throw those in if it's a less formal kind of.
So when is a jacket appropriate versus a suit? Blazer,
you know,
type
traveling, you know, cocktail parties, and I do a lot of guys whose business attire is business casual, you know. And what happened back in the .com era, you know, everybody thought they could shift to, you know, the casual wardrobe. So you had people coming in, including lawyers at some of these big firms here in Atlanta. They would on Fridays, you'd get off the elevator and there'd be a sign in the lobby that says, "Please pardon our dress. This is casual day," you know. And I've always thought if you have to apologize for the way you dress, I mean, you know, that's there's a problem. But people are, you know, here are these lawyers making, you know, $500,000, $750,000 a year coming in and, you know, chinos and, you know, penny loafers that are split down the side and faded golf shirts. I'm thinking, you know, that's yard clothes, man.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to be coming work, you know, in that.
Now, do some fabrics travel better than others?
They do.
Okay, so if you've got a real road warrior, that's a whole other different aspect to consult on, right?
That's correct.
I'm getting nods over here from Kerry, yeah?
That's correct. I mean, you know, it's a different animal right there, too.
So it's just like anything else. It pays to have some genuine professional expertise in an area like this if you want to be sharply dressed.
Well, I made a note here. We're going to work on a black ops wardrobe for you.
Cool stuff. Well, did you learn anything from this
today,
John?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, he's hanging out later because we actually are going to talk about this. I'm quite serious about pursuing this a little bit.
Now, you got to understand, there's a 90% expectation that clothes is going to happen
today.
Well,
with Stone, there's 100%.
For our listeners,
no pressure on you, Stone.
That can't see this, any of you that have been in the studio before know that I'm a jeans and boots and
short,
golf shirt guy.
And you know, flip-flops.
I wear a lot of black because I am short and fat, but I'm working on that too. So we'll keep you posted as this thing unfolds. Thanks so much for coming down today, man. And
I made one note here that I want to say.
Yeah.
I have an article that I did the vinyl thing on. What do you call it? The laminate.
No. Okay.
I used to carry it around with me all the time. And I need to get that back out, by the way. But it was a great visual. Here's a guy on the front of Wall Street Journal in the business section. Here's a money manager in a golf shirt and a pair of slacks. And then here's another money manager photo in a suit. And the caption read, "Who do you want to manage your money?"
That's great.
Okay. Yeah. Now, the guy in the slacks and the shirt may be a better manager, but if you're just going by picture,
yeah,
who are you going to go to? I'm going with the guy in the suit.
There you go. So we'll close out the session with that pearl of wisdom.
Let's make sure people know how to get in touch with you.
Yep.
If they want you to come out and visit with them and consult with them on this topic.
That would be boozermc@bellsouth.net. And I have a website. It's boozermcclure.com. Primarily just an information portal to tell you a little bit about me.
And McClure is two C's.
M-C-C-L-U-R-E. My cell is 770-377-0629.
All right. Well, Boozer, thank you for coming on board.
Thank you for having me.
And to all our other guests, thank you very much for an active morning. Got us bright-eyed and bushy-tailed for the afternoon. And until next week, be safe.
Get your wallet out, son.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. We'll be right back.